This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, everything that Richard and I have been up to Sunday, September the 26th. That includes having a look at the fuel crisis, the forecourt furore in the UAE. Is it actually a crisis or is it just a storm in a jerry can? We've been speaking to the oil expert and senior broker Matt Stanley from Star Fuels. Also, having a look at the fact that Emirates is rolling out the IATA Travel Pass across its entire network. It's been trialling it for a couple of months, but how big a deal is it that it's now going EK-wide? We've been speaking to the regional head of IATA, Kashif Khalid. Also, getting the thoughts of Emirates MBD economist Shadi Shaha Al-Borno on that cabinet reshuffle, particularly the new finance minister. And Nadia Swan has been in telling us everything you need to know about getting to Expo next week.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Size Business Breakfast.
Good morning, Nadia.
Hey there, Brandy.
Let's have a look at some case numbers before we get into the big week ahead.
Sure. Seeing a continued decline in our case numbers. So 321 new cases over the weekend from 327,300 tests. We have 398 people who've recovered. We've had, sadly, three more deaths. And we have 5,774 currently active cases. So as I say, that's a good 48 days of our cases going down so far. Brandy, encouraging news on that front. Just a quick look at the vaccine. 71,886 doses of the COVID-19 administered in the past 24 hours. And we're approaching that 20 million mark of vaccine distribution. We currently stand at 19,847,232.
Right. And these numbers matter, of course, because this is what we want to see ahead of Expo. The organisers, I imagine, are going to be very, very pleased to see those numbers coming down.
No question, Brandy. And there's been, with the vaccination campaign, we've seen those numbers coming down, the booster shots taking effect as well against the Delta variant. And so, yes, everything in place for a spectacular Expo coming up just very shortly at the end of the week, really, isn't it? Very exciting stuff.
Yeah, we've got a special Expo program from 8 p.m. On Thursday. Mark Lloyd is going to be hosting our opening ceremony program. Rich and I are going to be down there. Maria Boutros is going to be on the red carpet, as it were,
fantastic.
Near Al Wasl Dome. Tom Urquhart, he's just going to be Mr. Expo from what I can figure out. He's actually on the ticket. He's on the lineup. It's going to be fun.
He's on the bill with Bocelli and Ellie Goulding, isn't he?
He keeps some amazing company, doesn't he, Mr.
We're just going to have to rename the business breakfast to Tom Urquhart and Friends, aren't we?
That would be a show. If he could get his friends, that would be a show.
Us, Rich.
Oh, right, OK. He's got better friends than us.
Excuse me for saying, but he needs to show up first. He's not even here this morning.
Oh, he's noisy.
We weren't going to point that out, Nadia. Well done. Just throw your colleague under a bus.
He took the day off, didn't he? Don't know why.
Okay. I think he did.
He's clearly got a better offer.
That's okay. He's probably got a good reason for it.
Wasn't there boxing about 1 a.m. this morning?
Yeah, could it be? Maybe he was hosting it. Let's get ready to rumble. He's no stranger to a boxing ring. In a dinner suit, I might add, not in silky shorts.
Thank you, Rich. That was my guess anyway. Right.
I can't imagine that face being scarred, can you?
No, that would be a crime against humanity.
Two of you, I swear.
Sorry, I'll behave.
I'd say good morning, Tom, but we know he's not listening.
No, he's not you. You and your day off, you're up and messaging us at 6 o'clock in the morning telling us what we're doing wrong.
I am watching on an 85-inch screen, watching you on Dubai World TV. That is not Tom's rodeo.
Some people are gluttons for punishment. Listen, in the run-up to Expo, I just want to tell you some of the travel arrangements, Brandy, the RTA, true to form in Dubai, we have built an enterprise command and control centre. I know it sounds a bit sort of Star Trek-y, but it is the biggest and most sophisticated control centre world because of the thousands, millions of people that are going to be coming to visit Expo. So logistically, to actually manage the smooth transportation of people, mammoth task. So they have spent 15 billion dirhams finishing 15 projects to serve Expo to make sure that we're ready for it. So we've got the metro, we've got the buses, we've got taxis. And just so people can plan a little bit in advance trying to get down there, because you don't want to get stuck in all the traffic, So you've got 15,000 taxis and limos, 30,000 parking slots at Expo. And looking at the metro hours, which is probably one of the best ways to get there, you've got Dubai Metro Expo 2020 station, which will operate on the 1st of October. And they're going to synchronise that with the official opening of Expo 2020.
That was my question. I had a friend who's also going to the opening ceremony call last night and say, "Will you drive?" And my normal reaction is, "Yeah, sure, no worries." And they said, "Yeah, I'm a bit worried about parking and traffic. I just think it's going to be a bit stressful." Thanks.
Download the Kareem app.
I know, right?
Like the rest of mankind.
But probably even the metro and the trams and things, that kind of thing, is going to be a really good way to get down there. So you don't have to worry about driving, you know. You don't have to worry about getting stuck in car parks and things like that. Yeah. If you are thinking of using the metro, just a quick recap, the red and green lines running from Saturday to Wednesday from 5 in the morning until 1:15 the next morning, Thursday from 5 until 2:15 the next morning, and Friday from 8 until 1:15, and the trams also working pretty much overtime, 6 a.m. to 1 a.m. from Saturday to Thursday, and Friday 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. And of course you've got the buses there as well, so 6:30 a.m. in the morning, and that service will continue for 90 minutes after closure of Expo gates. And of course, as you point out, taxis, Kareem, or the ride hailing services, they'll all be there. So should make it fairly straightforward to get down. And of course the massive road projects that they've opened as well, actually, Brandy.
And Nadia Swan, thank you very much.
No problem. Details on all of those on the Air and News Centre app.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Do you know, I've just discovered that Ireland has effectively a minister for the diaspora, speaking of relatives far away and talking to them, who advocates on the rights of the Irish overseas and helps them with things during COVID, smooths the road back.
Presumably one of her or his KPIs will be tax them.
Well, no, one of his jobs is to smooth the period of physical disconnection between the Irish and home and abroad during COVID. That's really nice, actually. I like that. Can't comment on the tax. Right, let's have a look at some of the things that have been making headlines over the weekend. One is the news that Emirates is to roll out the IATA travel pass. This is the COVID information pass, your vaccine information, your PCR test information, after trials across its whole network. We are joined by Kashif Khalid, who's the regional director for the Middle East and Africa at IATA this morning, to tell us what that means. Morning, Kashif. How are you going?
Morning, Brandy.
How big a deal is the IATA pass being used across the EK network?
Well, it's an extremely big deal given the network and the scope of Emirates flight operations that covers nearly every major metropolitan city out there. So for us, it's something both that we're proud of in terms of our partnership with Emirates, but also how it elevates the passenger experience for the millions of passengers around the world.
Do we have any idea how many customers have used the pass so far? How many times it's been successfully used?
So we're currently in the final phase of the trials right now as we speak, but now with the announcement that we're going network-wide, we do expect a large number of passengers both having the availability in the application and being able to use it across the network. But at this point in time, I'm not in a position to offer a number.
Are we talking millions?
Well, it could be up to a million or more, given the number of passengers Emirates carries. And since it's available on their entire network, it's really now convincing the passengers that it's the way to go.
Now, do the passengers need convincing? Tell me about that.
Well, from what we've seen, passengers are quite eager to provide their information well in advance if it means they're going to have a better experience at the airport. And given the security as well as the strength that Travel Pass offers, passengers are able to have their information on their phone, so it's not held in any repository or any server. And they're able to complete all of their travel requirements remotely before they even get to the airport. So from what we've seen, over 86% of passengers that do download the app end up using it.
And how many airlines and now countries with Saudi signing up have you got using it? How close are we to it becoming the de facto travel pass?
So from a global government perspective, within the region, obviously, we have the likes of the UAE, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, but more importantly, in global markets, we did announce a few weeks back that we have the ability to use QR codes and certificates issued in all of the EU as well as the UK. And we have countries like Singapore, Hong Kong, Malaysia, and others that are coming on board, as well as North America, which gives us nearly 80% of global, let's say, mainstream traffic. So we're quite confident that it will become not only accepted by governments, but also become the de facto application out there.
Do we need just one? Do we need a de facto sort of, do we need uniformity here, one app to rule them all?
So from our perspective, we encourage governments to accept all mobile health credentials. We don't want to exclude passengers that may use other services. So from our perspective, as the industry body, we want all mobile health credentials to be accepted by governments out there.
How long do you think the IATA travel pass will be, I was about to say useful, I'm not being quite that blunt. How long is it going to be needed for? I mean, hopefully we're starting to come out of the pandemic. We are seeing a lot more borders, a lot more countries open up. How long do you think we will be showing vaccine certificates for COVID and PCR tests?
So the travel pass application was developed in response to the COVID pandemic to manage not only the complex set of entry and border requirements, but also the testing, vaccination, and other additional data elements. We do believe that while travel pass was created to address this issue, traveling during the pandemic, it could be scaled up or tweaked to include other data elements in the future, such as passenger locator forms or contact tracing information or other advanced processing information that governments or aviation stakeholders may require. While we hope the pandemic lets up and facilitates greater travel, we do see other needs or uses for the application, or simply just as an application to provide passengers the set of travel requirements for their journey, which they have to currently navigate using government websites, airline websites, and other forms of data out there. It could just be a single repository for the passengers to make an informed decision.
Let's have a look at where we are in terms of air traffic and recovery. We spoke to Dubai Airport CEO Paul Griffiths on Thursday on the show. That was on the back of the UK-UAE air corridor opening back up to some vaccinated UAE residents. He said something that made us pause. He said that he thought the airport would get back to pre-pandemic levels of traffic by 2025, which is a couple of years away and quite alarming given the role that DXB plays in global travel. How does that fit with your projections?
So our projections in the last economics forecast that we did was we did say that, you know, by the end of 2022 towards 2023, we'll see a meaningful recovery to pre-pandemic levels. But again, it's important to mention most of the airports in this region, as well as the airlines, rely on a transfer connectivity model. So while we do rely a lot on visitors or businessmen coming in and out of Dubai, we still are reliant on a lot of transfer market. And most of the source markets remain closed or to a select number of passengers, such as the Indian subcontinent, as well as other markets. Where we have seen in Asia Pacific and North America passenger numbers returning to pre-pandemic levels, our region still remains subservient to that transfer product. And until those markets fully open up, it will be a slow, pace of recovery. But from what I've seen with the UK opening up to vaccinated passengers, alleviating the need for quarantine with the recent introduction of flights between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And as we approach the expo, we're starting to see a number of countries open up and the UAE really welcoming a host of international visitors. I think that the recovery might be much more aggressive than forecasted.
What's going to push it further? Kashif, what would you like to see happen next?
Well, from our perspective, again, governments need to use a pragmatic approach to vaccinations as well as testing to open up, alleviate or remove the requirements of quarantine, and then restore borders and visa policy. And I think that's really what's going to get us back to those pre-pandemic levels.
Kashif Khalid is Regional Director for the Africa and the Middle East for Airports, Passenger, Cargo, Security and Facilitation at IATA Gulf, speaking to us about Emirates rolling out the IATA Travel Pass across its whole network.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-sized Business Breakfast.
More detail now on one of those top stories. The UAE has a new finance minister. This is significant because the last time the UAE had a new finance minister was the 9th of December 1971, just 7 days after the country was founded. It was His Highness Sheikh Hamdan bin Rashid, and he held the post until his death in March of this year. Well, we now have the UAE's second finance minister. It is also from Dubai, His Highness Sheikh Maktoum bin Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum. Joining us on the line to give us some context now from Emirates MBD is the Senior Director of Group Research, Shadi Shah Al Borno. Morning, Shadi.
Good morning.
What's your initial reaction to this news?
Well, I think, I mean, overall, if you look at the changes that have happened at both cabinet level and at both the Ministry of Finance, I think quite significant. I think the point here is a focus on agility. And this will probably determine the goals for the Ministry of Finance going ahead. It's all about setting priorities and approving projects and budgets for these projects in line with the vision of the federal government.
So what do we make of the comments from the Prime Minister of the UAE who made the appointment, Sheikh Mohammed, who said government finance will be driven by, quote, large transformative projects, not only long-term strategic plans? As an economist and as an economics team, how are you reading this one?
Absolutely. I mean, the key again here is focusing on the government wanting to be more agile in the way it is launching projects to transform the economy. And I think a key priority for the government of over the past years has been a focus on diversifying the economy, on making government more agile and responsive. And a real important delta in that is how funding is allocated to all these different ministries and all these different transformative goals. This is where the Ministry of Finance will play a very important role. And this is where this cabinet reshuffle that has taken place will focus. It's a focus on identifying these projects, on working faster on pushing these projects online, be they diversification-related projects, be they projects related to government goals and strategies.
We've also got a changing of the guard, one level below His Highness Sheikh Maktoum. He's the finance minister, but the Minister of State for Financial Affairs is actually a very important role, isn't it? Now, for the past 13 years, that's been Obeid Al-Tayer who's held that role, His Excellency Obeid Al-Tayer. But we've got a new breed now. So the new person at the ministry is Mohammed bin Hadi Al-Husseini, who's a businessman. His current day job is chairman of DOO, and he holds chairmanships in other organisations as well. Relatively young, very much a business background. You couple that with the economy minister at the moment, who's again new in the job, Abdullah bin Tukul Mari, relatively young guy, dynamic, and even His Highness Sheikh Maktoum is a young man. This strikes me as an almost a maybe I'm overreading it, but it strikes me as a changing of the economic and financial guard. Am I going too far there?
I mean, one way to look at it, Richard, it is putting in a new set of eyes to run the economy, and the changes we've seen and the new personalities that we've seen taking on the responsibilities and the new roles in the government are people who have had stellar records in business and in the economy. And the fact that His Highness has put his confidence in these people to run these key priorities and key roles says a lot about the direction the government wants to take. It wants to take a direction that is more responsive, that is more reactive, and one that is actually more pragmatic to the needs of the business community. So these are personalities and people that have a deep and ingrained understanding of business conditions in the economy. They are there. They are on the field. They work in the businesses that keep this economy up and running. So they really have the perspective that is necessary to undertake the government decisions that would make life for businesses in the UAE much easier.
Two final questions, just 30 seconds on each. First of all, what does this mean to people who are driving to work today? I don't know, maybe the woman who lives in Sharjah and owns a factory in Umm Al Quwain, or the person who's head of a multinational company down in Jebel Ali. 30 seconds on what it might mean for them.
I think what it will mean is increasingly we're going to see the government becoming much more accommodative to the needs of businesses in the UAE. You are going to see new projects and initiatives launched that will make business ideas, or that will make the realization of business ideas much easier, and that will support existing businesses with their growth plans in the UAE.
And a quick word, the UAE Central Bank, separate story, stating back end of last week, is going to gradually withdraw stimulus measures for COVID-19, introduced 18 months ago, the Targeted Economic Support Scheme. Again, 20, 30 seconds on that, Shadi.
Again, it comes at a time where the banking sector is at a very robust position. So the withdrawing of the stimulus is, as the central bank says, a very calibrated proposition. I don't think there will be any impact on liquidity. If anything, liquidity in the banking system is at a very healthy level, and banks overall seem to be in a really very robust position.
Shadi Shah El Borno, great talking to you. Appreciate your time this morning. Senior Director of Group Research at Emirates NBD.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We've got a lot of headlines coming out of the UK. Petrol stations rationing fuel. We've had some drivers come to blows in the latest worry about supply chains. Going to find out what's going on now with the oil expert and senior broker Matt Stanley of Starfuels. Matt, good morning. It's lovely to speak to you.
You too, Brandy. Good morning.
What's the story with the forecourt furore, Matt?
Well, you say they came to fisticuffs. Look, I'm from England. That part of the England, they wouldn't have had fisticuffs. They would have just written a jolly well strong worded letter to the Daily Telegraph. So it's not as bad as it seems. Look, it's some sensationalism from our favourite newspaper, the Daily Mail. I mean, look, it's nothing to do with a lack of supply of fuel. Let's just make that clear. There is plenty of petrol to go around. The issue is infrastructure, and it's something that you guys have been talking about recently. Your shipping correspondent and transport correspondent, Tom Urquhart, has done an excellent job when he spoke to Russ Edwards the other week. And it's a very important topic to be discussed. The issues are there, and they are now manifesting themselves down a supply chain to the end user. The situation has come and has come to this perfect storm. One, I don't blame Brexit. I think that issue was always going to come regarding European lorry drivers. It's to do with the fact that if you're a HGV driver, people, you know, kids who are coming from university don't want to be truck drivers. They don't want to be truck drivers. They want to be sitting behind a screen eating Popeye's chicken sandwiches and buying Bitcoin because they're allowed to. The average age of a HGV driver in the UK is 55, right? And they're not the most patient of people, put it that way. So look, that's been the problem. It will correct itself over the next few days. Because look, you throw enough money at the problem and it will go away. And that's the end, you know, where we will get to on this issue.
Okay, why do people think there isn't enough fuel then?
Well, I mean, because they read the Daily Mail, Brandy. You know, I mean, it's as simple as that. There is enough fuel. It's just getting it there. That's the problem. Look, BP run 1,200 petrol stations, own 1,200 petrol stations in the UK, of 200 of which they operate. It's franchise business. Majority of the time that you go to a petrol station in the UK, you don't fill your car up. You go and buy croissants and Rice Krispies. Other cereals are available. But it's not just buying the petrol. So a lot of these situations have happened because the petrol tanker goes in and then the HGV driver goes in and he discharges all of his, like I said, his croissants or his lamb shanks that you're going to use for dinner that night. So the whole retail game in the UK is vastly different to what we have here. So it's sensationalism and it's just panic buying. You know, it's a thing us in the UK do very, very well.
So if we have a shortage of drivers, as if you say it's infrastructure, what is the solution there? We've got everything from emergency visas to Boris Johnson writing love letters to retired drivers. What's most likely to work?
Like I said, I think if you throw enough money at the problem, then it will go away. The issue that Boris Johnson has faced and the current government have faced is they've had to be so dynamic in dealing with the crises from, I mean, I don't even remember talking about Brexit. That was all we could talk about 2 years ago. And obviously COVID has come in. So there have been several issues that they've had to really deal with in a quick amount of time. And I think that he will do the same thing. He will come together and he will talk to the Petrol Retailers Association or the Road Haulage Association or Eddie Stobart or whoever it might be, he will talk to them and he will get people back in trucks. And we should hopefully see by the end of next week a solution, and then it will roll out over the coming weeks.
How does this feed into the bigger supply chain issues that not just Britain but the world is facing at the moment?
That's why it's the Daily Mail obviously picked up on it. You know, I don't know the Daily Mail energy correspondent that well, but I can't imagine he knows what the spread between Brent and WTI is. God bless him. No, I'm being harsh in the Daily Mail, but it's the issue regarding the gas crisis. And your excellent interview with Mohamed Barkindo, that's OPEC Secretary General, on Thursday. I don't believe that there is a crisis, and I can't. Looking at this market and trading it every day as I do, I cannot form an argument for there to be a crisis when nearly 5 million barrels of production is sitting on the sidelines. That doesn't matter. The fundamentals don't matter when it comes to if you're at home and you're thinking about what you're going to have at Christmas, but your gas bills have increased 280% so far this year. You're looking at where your disposable income is going to go. So it will be interesting to see what happens going forward about how this crisis is averted. But the reason that people are picking up on it and is panic buying is coming is because they're reading the rhetoric behind it all and seeing that there is a crisis in other fuels, in other other energy power burning fuels that people consume. So that's it's getting carried away with this whole story, this whole rhetoric.
But we do have proper supply chain issues, whether it's port workers, whether it's containers on ships, or whether it's the drivers themselves. How long is that likely to continue?
Well, that is the trillion-dollar question. I mean, it really is. And it's a great question as well, and one that I'm not sure has an answer, Brandy. It's a situation rather than a question. And I'll echo what Russ said to Tom, Russ Edwards, Euronav, on the show last week. This problem was there a year ago, right? So if you just take an example, something that we all take for granted so complacently is where we're going to get our Christmas toys from. Inevitably made in China, go via Singapore on a container ship, end up in Jebel Ali, which is the Middle East's biggest container port, the ninth biggest container port in the world. And the infrastructure that JAFSA have, Jebel Ali Free Zone, is that it's so efficient, a boat goes in there, discharges, container goes blop, 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 and then goes in a truck and goes to Lane or wherever it might be. And then you go to Carrefour and MOE, other retailers are available, and you go and buy your Christmas toys. If you go back to the initial load port, which is Singapore, you can't change crew because Singapore authorities are not allowing that crew to be turned over because of COVID. Then you run into an issue if you're a ship owner. Well, I can't go into Singapore and load because my crew are too tired or I need to rotate. You start at that point and it snowballs. And this is the issue we're at now. How does it get resolved? Look, you just had IATA on. This travel pass is going to be key. Governments need to step up, really. And the UAE has done a fantastic job. I mean, what is COVID? We don't even know. We've got Expo coming up in 4 days. And everything is open. It's fantastic. But other governments are not as dynamic and not as quick. And they need to be in order to solve this supply chain issue because it's stemming from the load ports in Southeast Asia and China.
Do we have to worry here in the UAE about getting stuff?
Nah, we're fine. Absolutely fine. Look, the only thing I've got to worry about today is how much we're going to lose with the Ryder Cup buy. So it's no issue at all. Look, again, I say it, and it's the way that UAE government and other Middle East governments as well have reacted. We live in a regulated petroleum sector. So, I mean, look, when I was in the UK, same as you, I had £20 to fill up my petrol tank. If I was lucky, maybe you say, oh, can you put £10 in it, please? Actually, you didn't say it to anyone because there's no one in the UK who would ever work as someone who's a petrol pump attendant. You went in there and you did £10 to the dot. Here, you worry about how much you're going to fill your tank up by. It's a volume play. And we've got the Jebel Ali refinery down the road. We all drive past it every day, or we can see it from our houses. And that's where we get all our petrol from. And it's a fantastic situation we've got. You can get petrol delivered in the UK from CAFU. So we are fine. No issues at all.
Before we let you go this morning, Matt, let's look at where we were left trading on Friday, $78 for Brent. How did we get there, and what are we likely to see at the OPEC meeting at the beginning of next month? That's only a week or so away. You've got about a minute.
I want to be polite here, Brandy.
Please do.
Okay. No, look, it's we're going to hit 85. I wouldn't. That's not out of the realms of possibility at all. 78.09. Structure is heavily backwardated, so that implies that short-term demand is very good. The issue in the short term is that there is not enough oil to supply apparent demand quotas at the moment. We'll have to see what happens there. Economic data is going to be key. September payrolls are going to be key. Q3 hasn't looked that good for demand. India, Japan, China, all their demand has been down for crude oil runs and their refineries. But the market doesn't care. It shrugs it off. It looks at the US and it's looking at Western Europe. And they are on a trajectory that is only going one way, and that is up. I spoke to Vitol this week, Russell Hardy. He said it's going to 80. He told me that about 4 months ago, to be honest. And when you've got weight of people behind you, like Vitol and like the funds, piling into oil, it's a runaway train. So hold your hats. We're going to 85 before OPEC hopefully come in and give us a bit more oil, which gives a bit more gas, and we can all enjoy our Norfolk bronze turkeys, Brandy.
Matt Stanley of Starfuels, thank you for your time this morning.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.